Well, hello everyone. This one should be interesting because we're going to be talking about the Germans. If it's your first time here, I'm reading through this book, this old book by a Frenchman called André Siegfried, The Character of Peoples. It was published in 1952, and we're up to chapter 5. Just before we get going, I'll remind you, you can buy courses at the Academic Agency. The bestseller there is The Trivium. Latest course is Foundations of Shakespeare. I've written 5 books on Shakespeare in my time. Buy it now. So, without further ado, the chapter is called German Discipline. Let's see what Siegfried has to say. This should be interesting, fun, to say the least. He says, whether we like it or not, Germany is one of the essential parts of the European system, and she has had more influence in its modern development than any other country. She is essentially continental, and she has contact with Eastern Europe, which we, by we he means French, of course, do not possess. All the more so because, as we shall shortly point out, she is very greatly penetrated by Slav elements. She is authentically European, but can we say that she is integrally Western? Ooh, interesting angle so far, Siegfried. Many Germans aren't going to like this, but let's see where it goes. It is always a difficult matter to study Germany because behind an apparently rigid structure, she is a country of indecision and perpetual change. She is a passive country, prepared to accept any new saviour, and despite her passion for orderliness, she is fundamentally a revolutionary country. These characteristics have been exaggerated by her recent history, a series of upheavals culminating in a disaster comparable to an earthquake, which has rendered the previous scene unrecognizable. How much of the old Germany is left in the present regime, a regime difficult to define because it is neither a political nor a territorial structure, neither an urban or industrial economy, or a coherent ensemble of foreign relations. What still remains is the German people themselves. They have been hurled into a terrible crucible, but they are still very numerous and still with us. A striking thing about German territory is its lack of geographical individuality. In fact, properly speaking, there is no Germany from this standpoint. There is no geographical framework, no natural frontiers. It is difficult to know where the country begins and where it ends. On the other hand, there is a German people which, in such circumstances, neither knows nor is prepared to recognize frontiers. German unity does not reside in the bond which attaches the German people to a certain territory, as is the case in France, but in the consciousness of being, or the desire to be, a race with its own tongue, its own culture, and a sense of its own unity. Its perpetual tendency to spill over into the territory of others renders it a permanent danger to its neighbours. And, I mean, say what you want. If you're French, you can understand why he's saying this, given what they had just lived through. Anyway, let's carry on. And from this, a problem arises for Europe, which has not been resolved even now, because at the heart of Europe, there is a Germany which sometimes invades and is sometimes invaded, a country which is both malleable and aggressive, a country without which, and this is quite obvious, no lasting continental political structure is possible. Germany is divided into 3 natural regions, determined by geology and climate, and by that more subtle factor, orientation. There is the Rhenish Germany, a mountainous and geographically complicated central and south Germany, and finally the Germany of the great glacial plains of the north and the east. The atmosphere of the first is to some extent Austrasian, and of the second Swiss or Austrian, whilst the third announces the remote presence of Russia. Now, the fundamental division in Germany is less between the North and the South, as is generally believed, than between the West and the East. The great line of demarcation between the opposing orientations is not the traditional Main, but the Elbe. Two slopes now become visible, and in the Reich itself, two axes. The Rhenish axes, together with South Germany, which is essentially Central European with strong Western tendencies, and the Berlin axis of the Great German Plains, which belongs rather to Eastern Europe than to Central Europe, properly so called, which is instantly and insidiously penetrated by Eastern influences, not from the Levantine or the Mediterranean East, but from the Slav or the Russian land mass to the east. It is from this standpoint, I think, that we can best understand the German psychology. For Frenchmen, the Rhine Valley is still familiar, and they do not feel strangers there. At Cologne, in the Palatinate and the Black Forest, nature remains familiar to them. The trees and woods are much the same as in France. The general atmosphere is similar. It is even the same climate, though definitely more continental. Through this atmosphere, Rhenish Germany, with her close relation to the Alsace, Switzerland, and Austria, is also related to a number of our own provinces in the east, for instance, Lorraine and Franche-Comte, and I should even be tempted to include Burgundy and perhaps Savoy. From Auxerre, a subtle shade in the air, suggests that the traveller has left the Atlantic countries behind him and is now approaching a new part of the continent. And in fact, there is a Central Europe next to the sister to Eastern Europe. Its axis passes through the Rhineland and Switzerland, and its personality extends to the east, to Vienna, and in the west, to France, and certain remote traces are observable even in Lombardy. Political frontiers do not prevent the existence of a unit of civilization which extends beyond them. And coming from the Alsace, I can remember being conscious of its reality even as a child. The term Central Europe, associated with the idea of a time belt, evokes a whole geographical and social atmosphere, a way of life, thought, and emotional habits. To understand its intimate meaning is to understand Western Germany. By its tradition of civilization, it is one of the most essentially European regions of the whole continent. In this respect, Rhenish Germany, together with South Germany, is an integral part of Western civilization, which it expresses and represents in the same way as France, England, and Italy. Here, too, the Roman influence appears as a decisive factor. It held sway not only on the left bank of the Rhine and the right bank of the Danube, the limits of the empire, but also in the zone of military occupation and defence from the right bank of the Rhine to the Danube. Wherever Rome ruled, she has left indelible traces of her presence. The family, property, the government, the individual are not the same there as they live in other places amongst people who have never lived under Pax Romana. It can be seen clearly in the Rhine Valley, Württemberg and Baden, by contrast with the Prussian provinces in the east. It was approximately over this area that the French Revolution brought a wind from the west. Even today, one finds a conception of democracy in these parts, which is akin to our own, and an idea of the individual and of property, which is Western in more than one respect. A German from the west, and still more a German from the southwest, understands France and the French spirit better than the Saxon or the Prussian. If I seek to find what characterizes this Austrasia, it seems to me that it is to be found in a better organization of comfort, in what the Germans call civilization, as distinct from culture. And I think that's a reference to the demarcation that Spengler makes, you know, civilization and culture with a K. Let us say material civilization. In respect to social amenities, town life and material progress, of course, I am talking about the period prior to the recent catastrophe. These districts were more advanced than either France or England. It was there that one felt that sentiment of well-being, that warmth of intimate life before a cozy fire, which the Germans describe with a word which is untranslatable into other languages, probably because the thing described hardly exists elsewhere. And my gosh, friend, if you thought my French was bad, right, I'm going to give it a go. The word he's talking about is Gemütlichkeit. Maybe I'll be better at the German. Let's see. There is more spiritual urbanity in France, a greater refinement in social life. But one must go east before the war and to Switzerland even today and find the highest level of material comfort achieved in Europe. The atmosphere in East Germany, whose frontier can be placed approximately on the Elbe or even the Teutoburg forest, is quite different. When the Paris-Berlin Express on the Cologne-Ruhr route passes through the gates of Westphalia, which the Reich has marked with two giant statues of Bismarck and Wilhelm II, the traveller enters suddenly and without perceptible transition into that immense plain of glacial formation which stretches without interruption to Russia and beyond to Siberia. Is that gate still there? Is there two actual massive statues of Bismarck and Wilhelm? I'd love to see them if they're still there. Anyway, I'm sure somebody will tell me in the comments. The country which begins there was never dominated by the Romans. And at that point, we leave the Western Europe, which is so familiar to us, to enter into a new zone. I am almost tempted to say to enter into a new continent. Of course, it is still Central Europe, but one suddenly has the impression of having just crossed a frontier into the Asia of steppes and forests, immense and monotonous, flat and melancholy. The land is poor and the sand is the colour of ashes. There are very many coppices of firs which might remind one occasionally of our landes, but for the fact that the sky remains unchangingly cold and miserable. After the luxuriant growth of the Rhineland, one enters into silence and emptiness, into an area in which the influence of civilization has not succeeded in humanizing nature. There is still something wild in the countryside which pleases the romanticism of the Germans, brings man nearer to the elemental forces of nature, and reminds one, curious resemblance, of certain similar North American plains. As in some other continents, man's victory over nature seems superficial here, a victory which must be continually renewed, and there is an impression of constant struggle. In Western Europe, it does not even occur to man that his victory over nature might not be final. It is perhaps that perfect confidence which primarily characterizes our Europe. The countryside of France, for example, has been transformed by the age-old labors of man, until today it looks more like a garden. In northeastern Germany, it is very different. Geographically, the area is nothing but a march of the west. But nevertheless, I mean, I have to be honest, as he's describing this, my mind is going to so many like 60s horror movies I saw set in this kind of area. You know, it's just my mind is going to these things. But nevertheless, the West is authentically there, or at least it was before Yalta and before the Iron Curtain was clamped down. From time to time, the traveller meets it in the form of magnificent towns, aggressively modern, towns which seem to have been stamped out of the earth and to stand there fully equipped in the surrounding emptiness. There is powerful and methodical building on a mass scale and with mass methods which reminds one irresistibly of the rapid growth of American towns. But here it proceeds with all the rigor of Prussian authoritative control, deliberate and implacable. It is above all in Berlin, whose titanic ruins now rise impressively amidst the silence of a countryside of dunes, lakes and forests, that one can grasp better than elsewhere the significance of an achievement which is not spontaneous, but it is an affirmation of the West in a countryside which is geographically no longer Western. Here is undoubtedly one of the essential causes of the difference between Prussian Germany and France. We French do not realize to what extent we have become civilized human beings. By that I mean to what extent we have lost touch with nature herself in the process of our adaptation. The Germans have preserved that contact with nature, and it has exercised an enormous influence on their minds. A few miles out of Berlin, there are forests which are much more closely related to the forests of Russia than to ours. The limitless ocean of the eastern plains is close at hand there. One can feel its nearness, its very presence in the air, just as our western departments, one can feel the presence of the Atlantic, even when we cannot see it. And that liberation of the spirit of man, which our imagination seeks towards the west, because there is a great space of the ocean, the Germans are tempted to seek towards the east in the immensity of the Russian space, in which National Socialist expansionism thought to find a free path. Let us make no mistake, the profound attraction exercised on Germany lies in the east and not in the west. What the frontier meant for so long to the Americans in their drive forward to the Pacific is evoked, or was evoked, for the Germans by its equivalent in that ocean of still amorphous territories which begin at their gates and which they plan to discipline and exploit. In considering Germany, we should never leave the map of Rome's domination out of the account. And there is a second map which is no less significant when considering in particular the country east of the Elbe, and that is a map of Christianity's progress. It shows us that the Christian conquest reached the Rhine in the 5th century and the Elbe in the 9th century. The area between the Elbe and Russia was Christianized between the 9th and the 12th centuries. Though East Prussia and the Baltic countries did not become Christian until the 12th and the 14th centuries. That's pretty late, I have to say. From this one, we can see how relatively recent the Christianization of Germany was east of the Elbe, and in particular east of the Oder. It was here that the German spirit possessed a font of youth, which France, Romanized and Christianized for almost 2,000 years, did not possess. The historic past of France might be compared to a deep ocean, and that of East Prussia to a shallow lake. Wickham Steed once told me, in talking to two Californians, he had asked them, what was the oldest historical memory which was alive for them? And after some consultation, the two Californians had replied that it was the McKinley Tariff of 1890. During a lecture I delivered in Berlin in 1930, I quoted that story, and the astonishing reply, almost frightening for Europeans, as typical of the American historical outlook. But after the lecture, one of my listeners came up to me and told me I was mistaken if I supposed that the reaction of my German audience to that story would be similar to my own. Berlin's own historic past was relatively short, he explained, and in more than one respect, the Berliners felt rather as the Californians did in my story. From this viewpoint, the character of the German state appears in a new light, and that applies also to what Germany has done or tried to do in Central and Eastern Europe. the historic role of Germany in these fundamentally barbarian regions, which are drawn to the east rather than to the west, has been to establish a Western order. The Austro-Hungarian Empire carried out a similar program in the Balkans with, in the circumstances, some degree of success. Germany actually pushed forward the limits of the West, but in the end she failed, and she failed because she interpreted her action as a sort of colonization and exploitation based on her own supposedly imminent superiority. The conquest was made for Europe, but the conquerors themselves fell victim to some extent to the attraction of the conquered East. While Central Europe was buttressed both in the East and in the West by regions which shared its destiny, it played the role of an axis on which continental equilibrium was based. But the tide has again swept in from Asia, covering the zone conquered by the West, so that today Central Europe is a frontier area. It is quite clear that in this changed situation, Central Europe cannot play its former role in our disturbed Europe. But the astonishing thing is that a situation like this, which seems so new, is in reality very old. The eastern limits, I'm noticing the ghost of Mackinder yet again creeping over the analysis here. It's funny how often this situation keeps on coming up, isn't it? The eastern limits of the Anglo-American occupation today are approximately the same as the limits of the former empire of Charlemagne. No people has ever talked more about race than the Germans. But in fact, this people of racialists does not represent an ethnic unity at all. And one can readily distinguish at least three different races in its makeup: the Teutons, the Alpine, and the Slavs. I have to say that the mid-century Germans were well aware of this. I read some of their youth material once that they gave out in the mid-30s, and it was all about the Teutons, the Alpines, the Slavs, blah, blah, blah. They organized them hierarchically, I seem to recall. But anyway, the Germanic element represents the fundamental basis of the population, and, if one may say so, its essence. It descends from the Germanic elements of the Roman invasion, Franks, Burgundians, and the Alemanni, who formed the first curtain to the east. Then to the north and in the centre came the Saxons, the Goths, and the Vandals. Behind them were the Slavs, and then in Russia the Huns and other Mongolian tribes. If we go back to the eve of the last war, before the terrible racial mix-up which resulted from it, we still find the same order going from west to east: Teutons, Alpines, Slavs, and Tatars. The truly Germanic populations are chiefly found grouped in compact masses to the northwest between the Elbe, Thuringia, and the North Sea. Here is the real home of the race that is called Nordic, and which includes Scandinavia, the Anglo-Saxon parts of England, and outside Europe of the United States. Germanic racial characteristics do not appear to have changed much since the days of the Romans. To judge by the description given by Tacitus, they are dolichophalic, tall and well-built, with fair or reddish hair, blue eyes, and a light complexion. Gobineau launched the doctrine of their superiority, a doctrine which incidentally corresponds to the idea held by the Germans and in general by the conscious Anglo-Saxons of their own value and of the role they are called upon to play in the world. According to Gobineau's thesis, the Nordic is not necessarily more intelligent than the Slav or the Latin, but he is superior to them in character and reliability in that which is called a sense of leadership, and that is to say, the ability to command and dominate. And again, I have to say, from that literature that was given out to the youth in the 1930s, all of this stuff is in there, right? They talk about how the Nordic is good for leadership positions and to give commands and things like that. whereas the Slav is fit only for lower roles and things like this. Okay, it's in their literature. The Germans consider themselves quite sincerely and even a little ingenuously to be a superior race, and they compare themselves proudly with the degenerate Latins on the one hand and the inferior Slavs on the other, and their hegemony over the latter seems to them a matter of course, almost a statutory phenomenon. There is a second kind of German who is not in fact Germanic at all, but Alpine, sometimes called Celt, and to the south of the Thuringian forest he inhabits Bavaria, Württemberg, and Baden. These Germans are brachycephalic, dark-haired and dark-complexioned, and of medium height, and their stature grows less as one goes farther to the southwest. They are related to the Austrians and the Swiss and the inhabitants of our Auvergne. In travelling through Germany, one is struck by the great number of people who are manifestly not of Nordic origin. However, these people also share in the general Germanic pride, although from the ethnic point of view, they have no right to do so. And again, I will just say all of this is in the mid-century German literature. They talk about the Alpines being darker and still being Germanic. And in fact, they even include the semi-Slav, as they call it, as being a proper German as well. So none of this stuff that Siegfried is saying is made up, is what I'm saying. As a kind of diss on Germans, this comes out of their own literature. And a very important point, the German is also much more Slav than is generally believed. Between AD 400 and 700, the Slavs invaded the whole of eastern Germany up to the Elbe. Thus, the population of central and east Prussia, Silesia and Saxony are mixed with Slavs, Borussians, and in East Prussia, Lechs, Poland, Wends to the east of Berlin, and Sorbonians, that's in Saxony. It was only in the Middle Ages that this non-Germanic area was conquered by the Germans. The armed agents of this grand reconquest were the so-called Teutonic Knights, who established the marches. It was in this way that the Borussians, Christianized pagans, became Prussians. Earlier on, we discussed the spirit and the character of this policy. Even the appearance of the countryside was transformed as though by a powerful stamp. Crossing the frontier, which marked the limits of the Prussian administration, no more than a few yards penetration, was necessary for the traveller to feel that he had entered into another century and another civilization. But that was before the last war. Today, a countertide is sweeping away those old established traces. It was there the West ended, but the presence of the Slavs was still latent. The conquerors themselves were affected in Silesia, in Prussia, and even as far as Saxony. It reveals itself even today in the frequency of the names ending in itz or au. The psychology of the Germans is itself affected. What a fugitive suppleness can sometimes be met with under the outward rigidity of the Berliner, and how much the accent of the Prussian speaking French resembles the Polish or the Russian accent, and how much vacillation there is under the deceptive rigidity. One has the impression that this Eastern Germany is a Germanic superstructure built on piles driven into a Slav marshland. Nor does the Eastern influence end there, because there are the Jews to be considered as well, even after the mass persecution of the Hitler regime. Two waves can be readily distinguished. The first was that of the largely westernized Jews of the 19th century, that is, the Jews of Frankfurt on Main, in particular, leading financiers, part and parcel of the European economic system, and the Jews of Berlin also, admitted into the official circles of the empire, whose numbers greatly increased in the capital after 1871. By 1895, the witty Berliners were calling the famous Belvetrese, with its fine residences, which runs from Potsdamer Platz to Tiergarten, the Bell-Levy-Strasse. The role played by Jewish financiers in the financial operations of the Bismarckian regime is well known. After the First World War, a new Jewish wave spread over Germany, concentrating mainly on Berlin. This time the stock was more exotic and less touched by Western influences. It was something like the Jewish invasion of New York. An interesting point to note was that these newcomers, who became very influential under the Weimar regime, did not limit themselves, like their predecessors, to finance. They were found chiefly where business, artistic, and intellectual affairs overlapped. The newspapers, the theatre, the cinema, art dealing, medicine, and the law tended to become more and more their preserves. Thanks to this insidious intervention, which extended from the artistic avant-garde to financial advertising and communist propaganda, a subtle Soviet influence was, so to speak, projected into the German capital, which displayed certain non-Western traits, serendipitously Russian in a curious fashion. Post-war, First World War Berlin was often compared to New York, and superficially, there was something to be said for the comparison. Perhaps it represented just as much a stage towards Bolshevik Russia that would have been truer still of a filter town like Breslau, now razed to the ground, where the immigrant Jew first accustomed himself to German life. The German capital, outwardly aggressively Western, concealed within itself, largely on account of the Jews, insidious Eastern influences. I think he's saying that this new influx probably came from Russia, that they were Russian Jews. These circumstances led to the terrible persecution of the Jews under Hitler. German territory, Jewish influences have been ploughed up to an incredible depth. But even today, it is impossible to ignore the Jewish ferment in the German makeup. Bismarck himself noted it, and not merely to deplore it. And this is a quote from Bismarck. In mixing with certain German races, the Jews have contributed a museau, which is not to be despised, said Bismarck. The French, who have no spontaneous feelings for things Jewish because they lack intimate contact with the Jews, often make the mistake of regarding certain traits which are really fundamentally Israelitic as being of Germanic origin. A German Jew is not altogether like other Germans, even when he has adapted himself to the point of being hyper-German. He continues to think, feel, and express himself according to his own racial genius. The style, the rhythm of his speech, the thread of his reasoning are all different, and he possesses a certain denationalized clarity, which, it seems to me, makes him all the more intelligible to us. This is true, for instance, of Heinrich Heine, and in our own day, Emil Ludwig. However, the Israelitic element developed in such a fashion in Germany that it ended by becoming a part of the Germanic complex, and to such an extent that it is excusable for others to fall into such errors. Thus, the center for gravity of German psychology, whether under the Hohenzollerns or under Weimar, was disputed between the West and the East. The fact that there are now two Germanys with an indescribable admixture of races does not, in my opinion, fundamentally change the situation. Two main conclusions result from these observations of an ethnic character. The first, now what's really interesting here is that in his analysis of the other places, Siegfried leant on geography first and only latterly on ethnic considerations. Here, he basically said, like, it really comes down to the ethnic first before it comes down to geography. Kind of interesting why this is the case here. But anyway, something to do with the shape of the land and the endless frontier to the east. Anyway, let's continue. He says, two main conclusions result from these observations of an ethnic character. The first is the importance of race in the nation's concept of itself. For us, our nation is a civilization based on a certain territory and on no other. But Germany regards herself as a race rather than a territory. The Germanic destiny is that of the Germans and not of Germany. And this is something that actually Roger Scruton discussed in his very last book. He wrote a book called Where We Are, just after Brexit and just before he died. It's called Where We Are. And he talked about, you know, are we based on geography? Are we based on creed? Or are we based on blood, right? And Scruton's argument was like, Britain has to be built on place, first and foremost, where we are, okay? And Siegfried is basically giving a very similar argument for the French character, is built first and foremost on geography. Kind of interesting, he's saying that the German conception is built on blood, or at least it was when he was writing in 1957. Let's continue. For us, our nation is a civilization built on a certain territory and no other. But Germany regards itself as a race rather than as a territory. The Germanic destiny is that of the Germans and not of Germany. The idea that the French destiny could be that of the Latins, the Celts, or the Franks just does not occur to us. There is something imperialistic in that desire of a race to dominate and organize other races it considers inferior to it. The feeling that all human races are equal, which is so natural to the French, is foreign to the Germanic spirit. And that is perhaps the gravest obstacle to the establishment of a permanently peaceful system in Europe, and particularly in Eastern Europe. If the German had regarded the Slav as on the same plane as himself in the continental hierarchy, then the European problem would have looked very different. The second conclusion is that Germany, which is neither completely Western nor completely Nordic, is in a position to establish contact with Russia in a way which is completely closed to us. Traditionally contiguous with the Russian world, despite the presence of Poland in between, Germany is physically close to the Muscovite atmosphere. It does not astonish her, though, that she has always stood somewhat in awe of her barbarian neighbour. This explains German influence in Petersburg in the time of the Tsars and in Moscow subsequently. Thanks to this long contact, the German knows how to deal with these Easterners in Europe or Westerners in Asia. In addition, he is readily accepted there because it is convenient, not only as a technician, but as a broker, as an agent, and almost as an official. The Tsarist government had innumerable generals, ambassadors, and ministers who were really nothing but Germans. Bismarck, recalling the time he spent at the German embassy in Petersburg, has shown us clearly in his memoirs why this sort of Russian was more efficient than the other. I know that there is no love lost between the Russians and the Germans, and how could it very well be otherwise? But there was always been a sort of obscure complicity between the two countries arising from the turbid depths of a sort of remote relationship. All of this gives Nord Stream 2 a whole new kind of flavour, doesn't it? Anyway, let's carry on. With such a great abundance of ethnic elements, how did it come about that Germany suffered such a total collapse? It was because there was no fusion, no happy combination of these heterogeneous elements, because each one went his own way, irrespective of the others, thus becoming a factor of disorder and final ruin. The Latin contact, joined with German solidarity, resulting in an extraordinary analytical capacity. The Prussian element operated as a marvellous organisational factor, and the Slav element contributed a mystique, but also a lack of all restraint, which finally brought the whole system down into ruins. Each of these aspects, excellence in itself, arose at a place where one least expected it. There was no healthy combination of these elements, but an explosive juxtaposition. We all know Pirandello's piece, Six Characters in Search of an Author. The characters are all virtually there, but they lack the form on which their real experience depends, and only intervention from outside can give it to them. Such is the case of the German spirit, rich in possibilities, demanding only to express itself and yet always seeking a form and seeking it outside itself because of an inability to furnish it from within. Whilst France expresses herself perfectly in her civilization, Germany has suffered a succession of saviors, not one of whom proved viable in the end, and has remained perpetually in a state of becoming. Pathological incapacity, we say, but I feel that in their heart of hearts, the Germans secretly prefer this indeterminateness because even at the bottom of the abyss, it leaves open the paths of the future. Two philosophical conceptions and two opposed temperaments separate the French and the Germans, in that the one represent from the static point of view and the other the dynamic view of things. For the Frenchman, the static is that which has been realized and that which has been achieved. But the German regards what has been achieved rather as something which has been finished. It may be perfect, but it is unchangeable. And in his eyes, therefore, it is dead and without interest. The dynamic, on the other hand, represents the very essence of life to him, and life is movement. It is a current, perhaps uncontrolled, and whose direction is unknown, but it carries him along vigorously in an exaltation to some extent mystic. That perpetual state of becoming, we object, always remains virtuality. Reality involves achievement. The misunderstanding, which is based on the double and contradictory sense of the same words, is insoluble because it devolves from two opposing conceptions of being. Nothing. I mean, Siegfried has got pretty deep here, but I think he is hitting on something. My mind is going to Heidegger and others here as he's talking. Nothing is more opposed to our way of thinking than the German idea of the individual. We recognize that the German has a profound and important inner life, but it is so confused and so deeply hidden that he cannot succeed in expressing it. It is a kind of concentrated piety, free of all connection with action, which is left to the politicians, a quasi-mystic element, largely pantheistic, of communion with nature and with elementary forces of the air and the soil. Analysis and words are powerless to express outwardly such a state of soul. If the German does succeed in communicating it, then it is with means other than words. In music, for example, in song, the collective and vague excitation of an enthusiasm which one might term Dionysian, sometimes simply by shouts and imprecations. It is in this way that one can explain the astonishing power of Hitler's eloquence. Often unintelligible though it was, its effect was magical. German prose, considered as a means of expression, is a mediocre instrument, heavy, muddled, beating around the bush. But German poetry, which, moreover, is untranslatable, is splendid, in direct touch with the very being. If the Frenchman had to search through his own experience to find an analogous state of soul, it would probably be in his early infancy that he could find it, before his intellect had awakened and go about its work of disillusioning lucidity. This soul life of the German is not often visible. In what we can see outwardly of the German, the thing which strikes us most is the absence of personality, and to some extent the emptiness of his ego. Take them at the beginning of their being, writes Jacques Revert, before their formidable will has had time to operate, and there are nothing. They desire nothing, expect nothing, and claim nothing. The result is that they remain tentative, open to all possibilities, disposable, and essentially malleable. A government can do what it likes with this being who offers no resistance. And for the state, and for those who hold the levers of state, there is a terrible temptation in this. All the more so, although the German may not know what he wants it the moment someone else wants it for him. The will, writes Riviere, takes the place of everything else with him. One comes up against it again and again. Even the evil that he does is full of it, and perhaps it is the one thing which inspires it. Once let loose, such a will knows no limit, for it is reinforced by the most highly efficient methods. The qualities of which the German is most proud are, strangely enough, those of a good pupil. Unlike the frivolous Frenchman, he boasts of his flis, or industry, of doing things thoroughly, or grundlich. Sometimes we have the impression that his love of work, of elementary work, of work for its own sake, has something pathological about it, that he devotes himself to it less for the joy of producing than in order to fulfill a congenital emptiness. When method seizes on a Germanic spirit, it swallows it up entirely. The German is then so devoted to his object, so perfectly objective in his procedure, that once started off, he depends on nothing but his system. He becomes, to some extent, himself the thing he is pursuing, liberated from all prejudices and from all moral scruples, and logical to the point of ferocity. In certain of his achievements, he appears as a revolutionary, and, in fact, to regard him as conservative is to misunderstand his real character completely. Whether he upholds cubism, justifies abortion, organizes controlled births, reorganizes the state, or occupies himself in classifying sexual aberrations in alphabetical order, he is the perfect representative of the avant-garde, prepared to integrate every upheaval and every folly in a framework of discipline. However, I should put his objectivity in first place. An Alsatian, a keen and thoughtful observer, who knew Central Europe thoroughly, wrote the following commentary on Germanic Schaltlichkeit in a correspondence with me. The key to it all lies in a single word of magical potency, Wirtschaft. Moraes says, first politics, but where Germany is concerned, it is first Wirtschaft. In domestic politics, the perfect solution was that of von Schleicher in 1934. Direct collaboration between the general staff and the trade unions. To understand the semi-individual, semi-gregarious character of the German, you must have seen German workers conferring together in their trade union groups and German employers conferring together in their cartel groups. In contradictory regimes like those of Wilhelm II, conquest with a big drum, and of the Nazis, are distortions of Germany. And even if Germany has accepted them and seemed from time to time to have a real liking for them, we must nevertheless not let ourselves be deceived. The final aim through the state power is still Wirtschaft. How can we translate that word? By economy, which would be a rational thing? No, it is not a matter of possession in the Latin manner, nor of interest or accumulation in the French sense, with all the labour expended in France to this end, or an enjoyment in the Venetian sense. Let us take rather that other word, an ultra-German word, Sachlichkeit, Sachthing, Thingism, or, how dreadful it sounds, Substantialism. It is almost anti-human sacrifice of the person as an individual or in a group to things. That is their categoric imperative, which often takes them far in cruelty and baseness if things demand it. End quotation. This is Siegfried again. If you thought he was biased against the English, if you're German, again, this is a Frenchman writing in 1952. Anyway, let's continue. Although I do, I mean, there are parts of this that one can recognize that, you know, as well, but pinch of salt. The thing most lacking in this, and I tell you, the thing he talks about, the arrangement between the unions and the bosses and so on, that's one of the reasons why after he wrote this, German manufacturing, it was because the unions agreed to take lower pay. They came to a deal in a way that would be completely unimaginable here between our trade unions and the bosses had a very antagonistic relationship. That is not the case in Germany. So what Siegfried is talking about is not complete bunkum here either. It's not just French bias, although I would be hesitant to take everything he says as being true. Anyway, let's continue. The thing most lacking in this conception is the spirit of measure and moderation, which is the condition of all judgment. It is a dangerous thing to let loose without that being without passion, because it is the loosening itself which is passionate. It has often been said that the German lacks tact, and incidentally, it is the same thing. His Grundlichkeit throws him off the rails, and he falls with equal facility into the colossal and the infinitely petty, losing his balance and his common sense, not to mention his moral sense. This is the very stereotypical German, let's call it the flair for the total, or the total system that he's talking about. It's funny, you know, I was talking to the missus the other day about Germans. I said I was going to be doing this. And she said, like, I've never known how to take Germans. I can never tell if they're like being really dry in their humor, or if they just mean straight up what they say. And I do recognize that. Personally, I find I get on with Germans. They find them pretty funny, you know. I recognize that dry kind of humor that they've got, but they are kind of difficult to read sometimes as well, because you never quite know if they're like being fully serious. No, like messing around, no sarcasm, or if they're doing the dry humor. So anyway, let's carry on. His Grundlichkeit throws him off the rails, and he falls with equal facility into the colossal and the infinitely petty, losing his balance and his common sense, not to mention his moral sense. In his Neue de Charlottenburg, Paul Merlin Morland has illuminated this aspect of the German spirit. The Germans have an obsession for information and the urge to analyze, and information is so falsified by an excess of detail, the conclusion so disconcerting despite the efficiency of the method, and the nervousness so great, and the closer they approach the light, accompanied by so much blindness, that they can arrive in a parlous condition before the prime verities. This inability to choose, this fundamental lack of inner control, constitutes Germany's gravest defect. Referring to Napoleon, Maurice Barre spoke of a method in the service of a passion. One could say as much of Germany, which, remaining outside of Roman Europe, did not share with us the heritage of classic discipline. A great Swiss, who had associated with Germans all his life, once said to me lightly, "The German is tüchtig," that means capable, "Gerissen," cunning, "Aber dumm," but stupid. The German is capable, cunning, but stupid. And that is doubtless why the most efficient of states and the most powerful of armies nevertheless led the country to ruin. We have already met with some remarkable qualities: conscientiousness, solidity, industry, and labour. And yet, when we consider the moral conceptions of the Germans, we are inclined to draw back in horror, as though from an abyss. The thing which characterizes them is a fundamentally pessimistic view of the world. No man has impressed his personality on Germany more than Luther, Martin Luther. According to him, the laws of the world are bad in their source, and nature is delivered up to injustice and evil. In the worldly sphere in which the state moves, there is no other law but that of force, and the words of the Bible do not apply there at all. Man should live amongst the saints in a spiritual society, upholding the mystic independence of the spirit. But on earth, the prince has received from God the right to use the sword and the obligation to uphold the state in accordance with rules of which morality need know nothing, but which are nevertheless in accordance with the will of God. Thus, in temporal matters, the Christian is the servant of the state and makes no claim to improve the morals of an outward society whose essence is originally evil. This conception, religiously mystical and politically cynical, makes the Christian into a spiritual independent individuality, but debases him in the state to a humble and passive subject of the prince. Politics for the German do not imply acting in a fashion which meets with the approval of the moralist. Politics have their own special object, which is the life of the collective people. For the German, force is neither moral nor immoral. It just is. To German thought, the idea of introducing morality into the sphere of politics would just be nonsensical. No German ever believes that force will one day cease to be the decisive factor in the settlement of human affairs, and I have found this confirmed in private conversations with Germans during the life of the Weimar Republic. The German accepts the fact without protest and simply as a fact. After all, isn't that the rule of the game? His submission to the authentic manifestations of material power remind one of the Easterner. It is his form of the Russian Nichevo, and moreover, it lasts only as long as the reality of the opposing force is imposed on him. Thus, from this angle, the humanitarian idealism of justice or of peace appears to him as mere hypocrisy or naivety. This is the standpoint of Germany, not only in her foreign relations, but also in her domestic politics. Apart from certain areas in the southwest which have been influenced by the French Revolution, there is hardly anywhere beyond the Rhine where men uphold the conception of man as an individual citizen, the rights such as those laid down in our classic declarations, and carrying the essence of sovereignty within himself. What there is of democracy, and it is by no means a negligible force, expresses itself more in the urban or corporative group after the style of the Middle Ages. But then it does so with a spontaneity and a sense of collective liberty, probably more highly developed than that in France. As for the state itself, that is another matter. It is enough for it to be and to manifest itself by demonstrating its power. Its proper way to justify itself is by imposing itself on the amorphous mass which accepts it rather than submits to it, or perhaps the nuisance is subtle, is grateful to submit to it because it admires and reveres it, not less for the blows it suffers than for the benefits it receives at its hands. To use a philosophic term, which is always in place when discussing the country of Kant, the state is transcendent. It is not a community, as in the Anglo-Saxon democracies, but a distinct structure which functions in the hands of experts who are respected for their competence. What they do is no business of the people, who are incidentally quite persuaded that this is so. Thus, either as an isolated individual or as a citizen, the German leads a straitened life. It is quite a different matter once he joins himself to a group of his fellows. His deficient personality feels the need for a shell. As an amorphous individual, he needs a frame to fix his indeterminateness, and in fact, he cannot realize himself except by association with others. In an association, the Frenchman always has the feeling that he puts in more than he takes out, and therefore he is a bad associate. But the German receives more and knows he receives more from the group than he contributes to it, and he accepts its conditions eagerly and even with gratitude. The discipline indispensable to joint action does not appear irksome to him, and he regards it as an obvious necessity which he accepts with a kind of relief. In short, he feels at ease only in a group. It is in the group that he acts and he amuses himself and he indulges his enthusiasms. In this respect, I know no spectacle more typical than a German Sunday in summer, whether under Weimar or under the Nazis. One seeks any individual distraction from early morning. All ages, children, adolescents and parents march out on a hike as though to a conquest, trampling along in line with flags flying in battalions, platoons and sections. Their cheerful step, their singing and their organized progress are an affirmation of the power of the mass. And the thing is, this may sound ridiculous, but I have known people who've lived in places like Switzerland and Austria and in Germany, and they all say, British people now, they all say, thing is, they love a march, these people, they absolutely love a march. This sort of thing is just doesn't, you know, I mean, yeah, you'd have the parade or something once in a while, but like to go marching, it's just like this is something that doesn't happen here. Anyway, I'll continue. Their cheerful step, their singing, and their organized progress are an affirmation of the power of the mass. All they need is an objective and they go off. It is a disturbing sight, like a horde in movement. When they arrive in the country, they find other troops there, marching in line across the fields and carrying spades and pickaxes over their shoulders as though they were rifles. It would seem that there is no greater delight in Germany than to march in a line. I'm also like imagining like the seven dwarves for some reason, but anyway, let's carry on. However, do not let us reduce these human tides to the level of a gymnastic exercise or a sergeant major's joy. Frenchmen who have taken part in these marches through the romantic surroundings of the German forests confess that they too have felt a sensation, inarticulate but powerful, of liberation. They have been affected by the pantheistic enthusiasm they generate. Yeah, I guess they're activating what Jonathan Haidt has called the hive switch. You know, people experience this sort of thing at raves and things like that as well. Or, I don't know, at a football match in the crowd, you know, you get lost in the number, you know. I've always found it quite terrifying personally, but anyway, let's continue. Originally, elementary nature still surrounds, both physically and morally, these beings less developed than ourselves, and it is in this sense that they are, as they are fond of calling themselves, barbarians. I mean, we'll see about that. When the Germans watch this video, Siegfried, we'll see if they're happy at being called barbarians. Maybe they will be. I don't know. Such a form of self-expression, inadequate, incomplete, constantly changing and never definitive, is inconceivable for the French spirit. Under the rigidity of its outward shell, Germany gives on the whole of an impression of insecurity. With us, disorder is an outward thing only, a sort of fringe, a superficial froth, which we beat up with a kind of perverse pleasure. In Germany, the chaos is internal, and discipline can only come from the outside. We feel uncomfortable, and not without reason, at the proximity of this people, which can never finally make up its mind. Good judges regard this congenital indeterminateness as an essential characteristic. According to them, Pierre Vinot, who entitled his book Incertitude Allemendes, also held this view. The most typical period in German history was the 30-Year War. Our idealists of 1848 were much taken by a more attractive but hardly more organic Germany, philosophic, musical, good-natured, but woolly and inefficient in achievement. But it was this very same Germany which was about to adopt the imperial regime. Prussia offered her rigid administrative and military framework, and Germany squeezed herself into it with delight, taking on its form with docility as water takes the form of the vessel into which it is poured. Many of us were contemporaries of that regime, under which the country resembled a class with masters, a factory with foremen, and a barracks with non-commissioned officers. Efficiency was its watchword, and obedience followed an order like a reflex action, like a well-geared machine. And it was with a similar delight that Germany hurled itself into the arms of Hitler. After the Weimar regime, which Germany did not love, she found herself again, all she preferred in Hitler's totalitarian state, method in the service of passion. The turbid mixture of mystical paroxysm with technical efficiency. But at the end of all these experiments came the catastrophe, and she had to start all over again. The German soul is expressed in score of words, profound and full of meaning, but for us they are generally untranslatable. To begin them thoroughly would, I think, be to understand Germany. Almost all of them correspond to something collective, because German thought arises from medieval realism than from nominalism. The ordinary Frenchman regards only the individual as really existing, and for him the group is only a conception. flatus vocis. Flatus vocis. The opposite is true on the other side of the Rhine. There is a direct sense of the existence of a communion almost physical with things, which leads to the idea that feeling is superior to reason. Let us try to evoke the essence of this vocabulary, the profound source of things, echt, rein, the sense of force associated with the idea of youth, joy and brutality, storm und drang, fracht, frund, the mystical sense of development, werden, entwicklung, the emptiness, vagueness and uncertainty of the German spirit, schwindel, tief, chaos, problematisch. Sadism, a delight in disaster, schadenfreude, gottermangering, gotterdammering, sentimentality, heim, heimweh, heimlich, gemut, gumlich, gumlich, industrious and serious qualities, tüchtig, fließig, ernst, gründlich, objectivity, a sense of things as such, Wirtschaft, sachlich, sachlichkeit, spirit of things and mystic communion, Geist, Seel, Stimmung, collective conscious, Gemeinschaft, Volk, which we Frenchmen cannot translate by people. Germany's resources are astonishingly rich. My gosh, that was a lot of foreign words I just spoke. But if my German is even slightly better than my French, it's because I dropped French when I was 13 or 14, whereas I did German for GCSE for my sins. I still managed in a German oral exam to say things like "Ich licken mein Kalipper one." I actually did that. I still pass somehow. Anyway, let's continue. Germany's resources are astonishingly rich. A highly efficient technique exists side by side with a deep soulfulness, the whole creating a general impression of life. Comments are going to be fun of people saying, don't worry, eh? Your German is just as bad as your French. Okay, let's carry on. The contribution of the German people to European civilization is outstanding. They have accumulated an enormous mass of information, observations and classifications. They have produced music, poetry and philosophy. They were the real pioneers of industrial rationalization. And yet they did all this as a sort of compilation, a sort of thesaurus. They never succeeded in giving their creations a form. It is here that the barbarian, who is, it should be noted, proud of being a barbarian, the far-removed son of Asia, lacks the classic contact which comes from Greece and can therefore not be regarded as completely Western. He has not succeeded. I can see rightist types taking real exception to some of this analysis, but he wrote what he wrote. I mean, I've never really heard the argument that the German is not properly Western before, so it's an interesting one. He has not succeeded, like the adult people of civilization, in creating a synthesis of his contradictions. The German is sentimental, but also brutal and cruel, even vicious, sadistic and neuronian. He enjoys a catastrophe. He weeps at a conflagration he has started himself. He fondles with emotion the child whose parents he has just killed. His very obedience applies itself to the same ardor to evil as it does to good. To bring order into this chaos would have needed all the wit of a Voltaire. There was Goethe, of course, who desired and conceived the required synthesis, but other spirits were preferred to his, men who lacked measure, but who were judged to be more in the national spirit Wagner and Nietzsche, perhaps with a strain of Slav blood. Finally, Germany is destructive of resources, destructive of human life, destructive of empires. In attempting this analysis, I have turned towards the past. How could I do otherwise? But even in this country of saviors, there is once again a new birth, even amidst the ruins. Germany, we have already remarked, is hardly astonished at disasters, and perhaps she suffers less from them than we think, thanks to the singular capacity to start again at zero, to begin a new life, and to make a clean sweep of the old. Will she develop well or ill? We ask the question, but we are unable to answer it. Trampled down, scarred with deep wounds, suffering the most fantastic mixture of populations, divided into the western and the eastern part, present-day Germany, at least western Germany, seems more Catholic than before. Together with Prussia, Lutheran Protestantism was defeated in the war. Aesthetic by temperament, the North German Prussian and Protestant took a delight in renunciation in favour of an aim. He was prepared on occasion to sacrifice butter to guns. By contrast, Catholicism, less national perhaps, but also less strict, less fanatical, and more human. The country retains its respect for objectivity, the Wirtschaft we discussed previously, and that remains essential and permanent. Gründlichkeit was above all a Protestant quality. Perhaps in the ruins, Germany will lose something of her traditional rigidity, but her vitality still remains. And apart from Russia, she is still the most populous country in Europe. I conclude this study on a note of perturbation. What do we see outwardly across the Rhine? Order, efficiency, and achievement. But inwardly, it is a swamp, a chaos. Germany believes that the truth is obscure, and that in pursuing it, one plunges into the night. But we Frenchmen believe that truth is light, accompanied by clarity. Certain countries have original simplicity, which makes one think of a transparent wave without mystery. But with Germany, we are on the edge of a dark sea, and we fear that it is bottomless. That is precisely its glory. But when we lean over its surface, we feel as though we were suspended over an abyss. My gosh, the tone of that one was different, wasn't it, from the English one and the Latin one and the French one. But remember, he's writing in 52. He lived through the Vichy regime. He saw his country twice in his life invaded. So one understands why that one may have been laced with a certain vitriol that he didn't have for the English. But certainly, despite that, even if you take away that, still a lot of really interesting little insights. And also this notion that the Germans aren't really Western in the same way as the French, etc., is something I've not come across before. If this was like a typical French view, I was not aware of it until I read Siegfried. So extremely interesting stuff here. I can't wait until the comments from this one. Any of my German friends, this is not me writing. I'll go that with all the other chapters too. Anyway, pick up a course at the academic agency and I will see you next time. Judging by what he said about the Russians in the German chapter, the next one ought to be really fun as well. All right, see you next time, guys. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.